If you were going to attend religious services for any of the gods in any of the campaign settings, which one would you go to, and which one do you think would have the most amount of showmanship?
Oh man, there's so many pantheons. You're looking, if you want showmanship, if you like, I'm in it for the long con, I want a trickery god because the payoff there is going to be massive. I'm totally into that. I don't think I could tell you which one because I'm most familiar, although it's been a long ass time, I'm most familiar with the Greyhawk Pantheon. The Forgotten Realms Pantheon is where Dan thrives, and short of like the racial gods like Groomsh and Mugluhbiet and Coralon and Lolth, I don't know like the base pantheon. I've never had to research it. I will say two things really quickly. Don't worship the Theros gods. They're all petty in different ways, and it's amazing, like the Greek gods are, right? Like that's wild, and I love them, but they're absolutely crazy. The other thing I would say is Tiamat's a great option, as long as you are lower management. You don't want her to notice you, but you do want to be a part of that because a dragon shit is always rad.
All right, I can see that. I feel like there's too much risk of ending up dead, though, if you go to a Tiamat thing.
Only middle and upper management, or like the henchmen that go out to do the thing and get killed. That's why I want lower management. I'm looking for not a private, but not a lieutenant. I'm thinking like corporal, about that level, right?
Or you just become like a powerful lich and, do whatever the hell you want as long as you're not working against her.
Speaking
That was
from
one of my
experience, Casey.
characters. Yes. I know. I'm keeping it unexciting because T like immediately I was like Tiamat, immediately.
One of my favorite things to do is to not do the showmanship and have it be really, really subtle, and then have like the gods work in mysterious ways until they show the fuck up, and then all hell breaks loose.
I've experienced that.
Yeah, how's that working for you, Casey?
Not great most of the time.
They are literally on a ship right now. Before, like, we're about to play D&D in a few hours. They are on a ship that is being flown by cloud giants towards a mountain which has the name of a god on it on the map, but they're going there to resurrect a different god. So we'll see how this all pans out. It should be great.
Yeah, it's a nice smooth sailing, I'm sure.
Yep, it's great level six adventures, is what we do.
Welcome to the It's a Mimic podcast, where you never know what you're going to get.
Welcome back to It's a Mimic, where you never know what you're going to get. Today, we're continuing our discussion on DM tips in Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. I'm Adam, and with me today are Kyle and Casey, and this episode is called Environments, using some downtime to build a little character.
In this episode of the It's a Mimic podcast, this panel of Dungeon Masters will be continuing our conversation on downtime activities. Last time, we talked about crafting rules and selling and buying items. So this time, we're looking into what kind of choices a player can make to enhance their character.
Before we get into it, what kind of downtime activities have you explored in D&D up to this point?
One of you typed into the breakdown, almost none. And that's it's just such a minimalist, like, nope, nothing. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that's Kyle.
Yeah, I started writing that and then I was like, oh shit, no, this is the actual breakdown. And then I copy and pasted it to another thing. And I guess I forgot to take that part out. So
it's such an indictment of Dave's DM style.
it's all right, not just the DM.
Let's roll
the
initiative on this because I want to hear your full answer. Let's roll.
10.
13.
I also got a 13.
Roll off, Kyle. No.
13 again.
3. I dropped the 1. All right, Kyle, give us your full answer.
Almost none. Next.
How is that though? How is that doing almost no downtime stuff?
I mean, I would like to engage with it a little bit more, but I find it's like pulling teeth with my players, right? Like I have to constantly prod to get anything out of them if they're not sitting right in front of me. Like I couldn't even get a character token from one of my players for 3 weeks. So I mean, I feel like I'm just gonna try to save myself a little bit of heartache by not really trying here.
I feel that pain. And my players are actually really good, but we went to go print off our Hero Forge minis 10 fucking months ago, and one of the players still hasn't brought theirs to a session yet. So I feel it. Also, I understand your players are very much there for the combat and the plot, not for the character and the role playing, right?
Yeah, some of them aren't even there for the plot.
They're there for the beer.
Yeah.
So,
which is fine.
It's one of those things, like, you got to give a little to get a little. And, you know, I'm going to reward the players that try to engage more. And if you don't want to do that, fine, your loss. But it's a little heartbreaking sometimes.
Was I next or was you, Adam?
Oh, no, I'm sitting here with a freaking three. Go nuts, Casey.
Right, you got a three. So I, as a DM, haven't actually explored this. With the campaign that I'm running with my family, I actually didn't, like, they're brand new to D&D. And so they don't know about downtime activities beyond, like, sitting around the fire and having, like, conversation to get to know the players better, or, like, the player characters better. And then sleeping. Like, that's what they think downtime is. At one point, the cleric did spend some of the, like, 8-hour long rest, you know, reading a book that she just got to learn some stuff. But that was the extent. I think if I introduced the options to them, because, like, three of the four players are 13 and 14, that they would then go down the rabbit hole and be like, Casey, let's do 8 hours of my downtime because I want to learn this and this and this. And so it could get chaotic pretty fast, but it's just because of, like, the invested time and interest in it, because it sounds new and fun.
If I can be honest, for new players, one of the things that I like to do, and I did this with you guys a little bit when you first finally settled down and got off the road, is I gave NPCs that would provide options. So here's town time. You have 2 days of downtime. What would you like to do? And everyone would sit there and be like, I don't know, drink at the bar. And then NPCs would walk up with these in-town quests, which were very, very basic, but to be like, hey, we found a shop we're going to go check out. You want to come with, right? Or we are going to go do a little bit of research in the library. Do you want to come with? And this started to unlock the idea for the players, and it slow rolled for people. Now, most of my players back then didn't bite, right? Jamie wanted to drink, and Terry wanted to fight, and Jess wanted to go shopping, and there were no shops. It was an abandoned town. But, like, eventually we got there as we populated the town and whatnot. And so it was really interesting for me to go digging through Xanathar's and the DMG to find out what the official, like, rule sets are, because I was flying by the seat of my pants on that from previous editions, because I missed it in the DMG and I didn't own Xanathar's at that point. So it was, and the DMG stuff is so rudimentary. Like, there's very little information in that or the player's handbook about what to do with your downtime. And I kind of hated it. It doesn't move at the fast pace of Dungeons and Dragons, which operates sometimes, entire sessions operate 6 seconds at a time, right? And a lot of the downtime stuff takes weeks to get done. So I've had a lot of experience doing this across 3 different editions. And I gotta say, what they give you, the stuff that I was doing the research for today, pleasantly surprised. I am very happy with what they came up with. I would tweak it here and there, but it is the tip of the iceberg. There's so much shit to do. And I would love to see a full 250-page book based on downtime activities and NPCs, because there's a world of options out there. So
yeah, I agree. It was very eye-opening to me, too. I was like, oh, I'm inspired now. I think I should add this in. It's like missed opportunity if you don't engage in it at all through a campaign, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, that's how I feel about your players, Kyle. Like, I know your group. I know every member. I think actually your cousin plays with you now. I think I only met him in passing once.
Yeah, he does.
But I know the rest of them all pretty well. I've known them all for years, and they're not, they're
the sharpest tools in the shed.
Sorry?
Not the sharpest tools in the shed.
Not really. That's not what I was going to say. I mean, look, James and Dave play in that group, and they are very much sitting there trying to work an angle at any given time, right? But they are bombastic pyromaniacs full of bloodlust, right? There's not even, I don't even think any of your players are particularly horny the way that some DM like D&D tables are, right? They're just there for the murder.
Yeah, that's an accurate assessment.
So this, I hope this doesn't make you like get disappointed in your players as we talk about these episodes on downtime, Kyle.
You know what? It's some parts of it have, and then I think some parts of it have actually given me a really good idea, right? Like I'm going to be talking about religious services later, and I have one of the characters at my table is playing a cleric to Ogma, the god of knowledge, and he's actually like kind of engaging in terms of his backstory, although he started with like a blank character sheet and he's like, I'm just going to write it on the way. So it's going to be a good way to engage, I guess. I think I have some ideas from this, but
I'm all for it. I also like the building a character as you go for the first few sessions. That's what we did for tier one, right, Casey, where we like figured out the characters. And then we finished tier one by killing half of them. But like we really took our time to learn them. And we are now getting to the point where we have learned three of them really well. And three of them are now starting to come into their own. Right. So, I like that. The slow realization of who you're playing. That's one of the things that I think Charlie does really well is as much as he knows who his character is, he's surprised by the choices he makes in the moment. Right.
Yeah.
So, anyway, before this conversation meanders somewhere it shouldn't, let's check out an info break.
We've previously covered quite a bit in our discussion on Dungeon Master Tips in 5th edition. For all of those episodes and more, you can follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and dozens of other podcast apps. And if you'd like to support us, you can donate through the website, check out our store, or join the Patreon and get access to other episodes and series. If you'd like to pay for some ad space on It's a Mimic, or just send a shout out to a friend, please reach out to us through our email and website that are listed in the show notes below.
This week on the It's a Mimic podcast, we've already done this week. This is the second episode this week, so we don't have to do this again. So I thought I'd use the opportunity to kind of break down what's going on over on the Patreon these days. So we have 6 tiers, and as I talk about them, understand that these are all in US dollars, because that's how we have to set up our Patreon. But it does the exchange rate for you when you sign up if you're from another country. So for $2 US, we have our brass egg tier, and that one offers nothing. It is really just an opportunity because we had a handful of people saying, hey, I don't want anything from you. I don't want to sign up for Patreon, but I want to just support you guys with a couple bucks a month. So that sits there as just a way to idly support the podcast for, you know, about the cost of a cup of coffee a month. The next one is the Copper Wormwood tier. And you can see that we are going with the theme of metallic dragons as they age. So with the Copper Wormwood tier, you get access to every 2 weeks, there's a campaign builder episode. Tyler is the one that is really running this show. I'm on all the episodes with him, but he's the one that's doing all of the editing. What's really cool as well is that the opening theme is consistently evolving as the campaign builder evolves as well. And as it stands right now, there's about 30 episodes on there. It's going to just keep rolling. We're really proud of this one. This is probably the tentpole, and we make it available for everybody at the really basic tier of the It's a Mimic Patreon. We're currently in the middle of tier 3, which means we're talking about roughly level 11, 12 in that area, and we're starting to get into some really decent like warfare level stuff. The next tier is the Brass Young tier, and it's about $8 US a month, and it gets you all the campaign builder stuff, as well as all of the legend lore that we release, because we're going back, we're reviewing absolutely every single one of the publications that's come out so far in 5th edition, and we should actually have done all of them by the end of the year. The other thing that it gets you, though, is the Legend Lore Online, where I sit down and I go over all the stuff in D&D Beyond, and some of the other stuff in DM's Guild, where we go through the publications. It's usually just the Wizards of the Coast stuff, but I've done all of the PDFs, like One Rung Above, and Lokatha Rising, and the Lost Laboratories of Qualish, and all of these PDFs that were released, including the Christmas charity releases as well. So, should you spend the money? Should you bother to hunt it down? That's what that series answers. And there's, in total, on there, about 30 Legend Lore and Legend Lore Online episodes as well. The next tier is the Silver Adult tier, And this is the last one that gets you additional episodes. And so this is where we get both the homebrew and the bonus episodes. In the homebrew series, I've covered a lot, including how I have handled the deck of many things, how I've handled the False Hydra, and we're currently working our way through my homebrew pantheon, which a lot of people were asking for. And so there's a multi-part series in there. It's going to be, I want to say, 9-10 episodes or so, just based on the pantheon and how I built it, including how and why I wrote the multi-page Bible. Every one of those episodes, if you go onto the Patreon itself, instead of just getting the episodes through your Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever, if you go into the episode, you can find that there's actually the Bible included with that. So as the episodes come out, there's an attachment on each episode, which is slowly releasing the whole thing if anybody else wants to use that in the future. Additionally, we do all the bonus episodes, and the bonus episodes have been wild. It's been everything from bloopers for the L5R series through to, like, bonus monsters. We've done bonus playable races, like we covered the Kender and the PDF races, like the Tortle and Lakatha and whatnot. We've also had just some random rants as well. Jeff and I had a rant. I went off about all of the different rules that I couldn't remember, that I found difficult to keep straight in my head. Sean and I just fucking rambled about a trope one time and about why stories are so important. I sat down with Casey one time to talk about the Forgotten Pillar, which of course is exploration, and some tips for her as a new DM. And so, like, there's just a lot going on in there. We've got everything from undead bonuses to celestials, and anyway, there's been a bunch of additional bonus episodes. And between the bonus episodes and the homebrew episodes, that's another 30. So that means that if you are tuning in at the Copper Wyrmling, you're getting roughly 30. At this point, of course, there's more and more every month. If you are checking out the Brass Young, then you're getting 60 episodes. And if you're checking out the Silver Adult tier, then you will end up with close to 120 episodes. I know that there's some more posts in there as well. There was a couple of things on NPCs that are posted and a couple of documents. And so there's more in there, but those are kind of sprinkled in as we run across them. So above that, we have two other tiers. And then, of course, there's the Gold Ancient tier, which is above that, which we dedicate a special episode on the Patreon to anybody of the Gold Ancient tier once a quarter, where they can ask questions and we will answer them as best we can. And then beyond that, there's the Metallic Great Worm, which are the ones that you guys hear on the public channel, where we sit down with the patrons that are paying that, and that's $45 a month. And we do these long, rambling 2 to 3 hour episodes focusing on one part of DMing or world building, but it's really whatever topic you want. So anyway, that's what the Patreon has to offer. When you sign up, you get a bunch of stickers that are sent to you. If you change what tier you're at, you'll get more stickers sent. And of course, everyone will have access to the Patreon Discord as well. So when you sign up within the next 24 hours or so, I will send you a link to the Discord, and then you can get on there to do the trivia and to talk about a whole bunch of different things. We've got a bunch of different channels in there, including one devoted to D&D, one devoted to the latest episode, one specifically for mailbag questions, one for other games and systems besides D&D. Our random topics one is just wild. It's just, I don't even have words for it. There's one for art and minis and props for people to show off and brag and ask questions about how different painting styles work and whatnot. And then, of course, we have our D&D trivia that Robert runs and that most of us are surprisingly terrible at. So it is a lot of fun, and all of that comes with absolutely every tier from Copper Wyrmling on up. Anyway, I just wanted to throw all that out there again in case anybody had any questions. I know we've got a whole bunch of new subscribers and stuff, specifically on YouTube, and I figured it was time to revisit this. It's been up and running for over a year. There are dozens of episodes on there, and it's a wonderful little community that we have. But for now, let's get back to the episode. Okay, so downtime. We talked last episode about crafting and buying and selling magic items and potions and scrolls. And crafting is the big thing that everyone always talks about. Like when you talk about downtime, you talk about recovering hit points and you talk about crafting. Those are the big deals. After that, it's the bard is putting on a show in the tavern and someone is hitting on a hot person, a hot NPC somewhere. And that's all perfectly fine. But there are actual legitimized, gamified activities to be done in downtime that fifth edition gives you a fucking list of. The problem is they're spread around a number of different books and they're not ever the focus of any written campaign, right? So these are things to just throw in here and there. The places you can look for it are in the player's handbook, in the adventuring section, in the Dungeon Master's Guide, and in Xanathar's Guide to Everything. That's where you're going to find all of your info. I'm curious, next year we're going to get the new Player's Handbook and the new Dungeon Master's Guide, and I wonder if they're going to flesh this out or how they're going to all include it. So anyway, let's jump into it. But before we go any further, I have to say there's one thing I need to remind everyone about, and that's the fact that the game designers know this, but you may have forgotten that in the Forgotten Realms, and therefore all considerations of 5th edition D&D mechanic design, unless it's specifically mentioned somewhere else, a week is 10 days long. So when it mentions a work week, it doesn't tell you what that means. The way that I run it, I try to break it down as close as I can to be it a 7-day work week and a 3-day work weekend. There's a lot of phrasing in this. It says it takes a week or a certain number of days or a work week. Think 7 full days of working, not 5.
Fair.
So the downtime activities section of the player's handbook is pretty sparse. There's like a page and a bit. We talked last episode about all of the crafting stuff, but let's get into the downtime revisited section in Xanathar's. Xanathar's Guide to Everything gives us a lot of new options for downtime activities, but there are 4 pieces of great advice right off the bat, and 2 of them are just kind of implied, but anybody with some reading comprehension should pick this up. The first one is, if your players are too rich, you can use downtime to eat up the players' resources. It doesn't have to be you buying items or renting services. You can just get them to pay cover to get into places or spend money on passive things like researching and whatnot. Every downtime activity should have a clear resolution and a complication that makes it interesting. If it's just a quick roll and there's no complication, you don't have any tension with it, right? The third thing is downtime activities that are listed are just examples, and you should be inspired to make your own. That's very much hinted at, but never directly stated anywhere. And the last thing is you should add in-town rivals to add depth to your games. Now, there's a bunch of information about rivals. Actually, there's like 3/4 of a page devoted to it. And there's an incredible D20 table of examples to choose from. I rolled randomly for the 3 of us before this episode started to see what rivals that we would have in town that wouldn't necessarily be following us out into our adventures in the wilderness. I got a traitorous noble looking to foment a revolution. Casey has a spurned romantic interest who is out for revenge. Ooh. And Kyle has a fiend looking to tempt the characters into evil. So good job, guys. The general breakdown, though, is that you as a DM need to understand your rivals' goals, assets, and plans. And included in these plans are both actions that they want to take and events they might be interested in attending, creating, using, or stopping. I really like the idea of rivals, and we should keep that in mind as we move forward through the rest of the episode, because it's one of the major themes in Xanathar's. The very first thing that I wanted to look at, though, was the idea of recuperation, because that's the big thing that everyone looks at. What can a long rest get me? And when it comes to the idea of a long rest, the way that we've been doing it in our campaign is that once a long rest is done, whatever conditions have afflicted you just kind of go away. That's just how healing works, unless it's specified otherwise, right? Sometimes it's like, at the end of a long rest, you can retry this roll. Sure, those ones are specific, but whenever like you take stat damage, how do you get that damage back, right? If you, like, we know what exhaustion is like, but if you catch a disease, how does that work? So there's a section in the player's handbook called recuperating, and it says that if you wait 3 days, you can roll a DC 15 constitution check to roll with advantage to end 1 injury, disease, or poison effect. So you have to wait 3 days and then roll a DC 15 con check. Alternatively, you can wait the 3 days and without rolling, just remove whatever it is that's making it so you cannot regain hit points. And there's a lot of effects out there like that. But again, 3 fucking days. That is a scary amount of death saves that you're going to have to roll if you're at zero hit points and can't regain.
I feel like this is conditional if you are using the hero healing methods, right? Where a long rest is a week.
No, this is just standard. But like, I'm with you. It feels like a really long time. But there are other downtime activities that take way fucking longer. Yeah. So this actually got an update, and it's called relaxing. It's relaxation, not recuperation. Relaxation in Xanathar's says that it takes 1 week, and you need to maintain a modest lifestyle, which means you need to spend one gold piece per day. And then you gain advantage on saving throws to end the effects of diseases and poisons. It's not just a DC 15 con save. You just have to reroll whatever the save is, but now you have advantage. On top of this, you can just end whatever effect is keeping you from regaining hit points, or you can restore one ability score if you've been reduced somehow. If you've got multiple diseases, multiple poisons, or multiple stats that have been drained, A, your DM hates you, and B, your dice hate you. And C, you've got to wait multiple weeks to get rid of this shit. This doesn't work, however, for any kind of issues from magical effects, spells, or curses. Now, to be really fucky, Xanathar's also recommends interrupting the relaxation with rivals or events of some sort. But I would have that ruin the day's rest, because it says nothing about the 10 days needing to be consecutive, right, for that week's rest. So we've gone from the DMG, which says it takes you 3 days and you can make this check, to it now takes 10 days and it gives you advantage. So Xanathar's is a lot more punishing, but honestly, I exist in a world that's pretty brutal, as Casey knows. So I like this, as a matter of fact. Let's grab dice. Let's roll initiative. I've got a couple of questions. 14.
16.
What'd you get, Casey?
16.
Casey, you're first. When it comes to the relaxation, is there a specific class, race, background, archetype, anything that stands out as being thematically tied to this pastime? Or does this just apply to everybody altogether?
Well, I feel like it has to align more with more classes that are religious, or you are meditating, those types of classes, like monk, cleric, potentially paladin, where maybe you are using it for gaining that extra time and use it, and that might give you an advantage for recovering from that stuff. Like, I would feel like perhaps a monk who is very proficient in meditation, especially if it's like an elf monk, maybe you would add in a little bit more to speed up that time, that relaxation time. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that I think about is that relaxing is going to mean different things for different cultures here. So a dwarf is going to be relaxed at a bar, but that might drive a firbolg up the wall. A firbolg might want to go walking through the forest, right, for its relaxation recuperation time. Yeah. I am legitimately thinking about this less like bed rest and more like R&R, being on vacation. What's the thing you want to do? A mage might go to the library and read, not necessarily do research, but read, right? So there's definitely some archetypes that are going to lean into this, but I think this is going to be most useful if you've got a lot of marshals in your party, and you need to keep them engaged, because they're the ones that are going to get hit by all of these status effects and whatnot. So they're going to be the ones that need this. I may tweak it a little bit depending on how much disruption this provides to the campaign plot line, right? If you're in the middle of hunting down the Cult of the Dragon, or you're on the road to Storm King's Thunder, like to the next position, you don't have time for this shit, right? So I might use the 3 days and the DC 15 con check instead of the 10 days, right?
Yeah. It adds that extra, it adds the, I guess, the threat of enduring long-term damage versus, you know, just, it's a really awful combat, somebody takes points of exhaustion, but then we all go to bed and we move on the next day. It's like, it's kind of carrying on that damage so that the players realize how bad it actually was.
If I can be perfectly honest, in our campaign, our homebrew, we have a lot of time between places. Like, we can really stretch out. We've been following a calendar. We spent over a year in the last few months, you know, really protracting this. But in Kyle's Mad Mage or the Radiant Citadel, it'd be two very different things, right? You guys are doing the Mad Mage for a while. You don't have 10 days.
Yeah.
But if you're doing Radiant Citadel, you could. You could have 2 months between adventures, right? Mm-hmm. Casey, you're running Radiant Citadel too, right?
No, Candlekeep.
Candlekeep. Yep. That's right. Sorry. Kyle's on Candlekeep too.
Candlekeep is also a great example for that, right? Like there is a lot of downtime available between sessions, right? Like,
yeah, that's what I meant. They're very much constructed the same way. So, but Kyle, you're running your homebrew now. Is that right?
Yes, I am running my homebrew, which I would like. It's almost like entirely contained within a city. So I hope there would be a lot of downtime for it. Personally, for me, like relaxation, it feels, I don't like it because it feels like I'm cheating players out of their downtime, right? Like one player has to spend their whole like downtime doing relaxation while the others are out carousing and pit fighting and all that stuff, right? It just feels, I don't know, cheap.
This is a point that I'm glad you brought up. I was going to save it till later. But how do you break down a day? Because the way that I break it down is I break it into thirds. If it's 24 hours long, you need one third of rest. It doesn't have to necessarily be sleep. You can sleep for 6 hours, but rest for 8 hours. And then usually two activities. One of them should be relaxing. The other one should be something else, right? I will give you the benefit because it says it takes a week, but it doesn't indicate how much of each day for that. So if I myself were to spend 8 hours of the day chilling out watching Netflix, I will recharge my batteries over the span of 10 days, right?
Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying about cheating the players. And what I would do is, A, we're going to take this time because you need to recover. Everybody else is going to have the opportunity to do a couple of things a day. You get to relax, and there will be NPCs involved. You're not just watching Netflix. People will be coming to interact with you, but it's going to be low key, right?
Yeah. Interesting. Honestly, it never even occurred to me that you can mix in downtime activities with regular adventuring abilities. I always was kind of under the impression that for a downtime activity, that is, you're devoting your whole time to it, right? Like if you are going to go do religious services for a church, like that is 8 hours a day for a full work week that you're going to be doing it.
Yeah, but it is just 8 hours a day, right? Like I make a point for my own professional life to work 8 hours, not 7 hours and 59 minutes, not 8 hours and 1 minute. I work 8 hours. They pay me for eight, they get eight. And I've always been like that. I think that, total sidebar, you earn your raises and promotions beyond those 8 hours, not during. However, for the most part, I'm stuck in a job now where I just get regular raises annually, and there is no promotion available. I'm as high as I'll ever go. So they get my 8 hours. Hard stop.
Judging by how much time you spend on Discord during the day, I doubt they're getting a full 8 hours of work out of you.
I don't take lunch breaks, so I am okay to be, I consider the 3 minutes here and there to be all right. I can do that 20 times during a day and I'm just fine. Although you're probably right. I hope my boss doesn't listen to the podcast. But I do know that I also have 8 hours of downtime because God knows I'm not getting 8 hours of sleep a night. So what am I doing with my downtime besides the basic cooking and cleaning and laundry and commuting and that kind of shit? What am I doing? That's up to me. How do I want to fill that time? And how do my D&D characters want to fill that time too, right?
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. That's interesting. Actually, that's great. I honestly can't believe I'd never even thought about the concept before.
You haven't had a whole lot of opportunity fucking around with downtime. So that makes sense. My other question is, do you guys have a quick plot hook or a call to adventure that you could tie into this? Or do we just leave it as recuperating?
Okay, actually, I do kind of have one that kind of ties into the rival you gave me earlier. I'm just imagining like an imp that is constantly following around your party. Maybe you like took food out of its mouth or something, and its sole goal is just to disturb any sort of free time you have.
That is like just the most Adam NPC of all time, and that would be absolutely horrible.
Like you're sleeping, and then all of a sudden it comes and just pulls one hair out of your head. And
out of your nostril, right? Yeah. Like it just wants to fuck with you. So I'm all for it. Honestly, if my players, because I've done this to Dan so many times because I've been a frontline fighter for so long. He takes so much damage. I'm going to let him just recover and give him a couple of fun NPCs to talk to build some relationships. I'm not going to make it any more punishing for him. But then there are people like Dave or Casey who tend to be more passive in downtime activities. Then I throw shit at them. Here we go. Yeah. Let's spend enough of a spotlight on it so that we feel like we've accomplished something here.
Well, and that's kind of where my brain went, was if you want to kind of force your players to entertain the idea of doing something other than just your long rest and, you know, going to drink ale at the pub. Like when you have a big battle and somebody gets injured for whatever reason, maybe they aren't healing as they should in these sequential days or this week of recuperation time. So in that, once it's realized, other players then have to dive into other downtime activities like research or seeking out like more knowledge or getting trained, because you find out, oh, the only way to get rid of this is actually for our wizard to learn this new spell or to learn this new, using this new tool or something. So you could kind of then parse it out that way with just a single plot hook of, by the way, you're like, the barbarian doesn't seem to be getting better. Why?
Yeah, and honestly, I think this is a great way to introduce your hag curses or your cursed item or whatever as well. They have to do more research.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Yeah, I like that.
All right, who's got the next thing?
All right, yeah, that moves us into training to gain levels. So we're going to start with the DMG. So sometimes your DM might set up your leveling with actual, not just going and spending a lot of experience time out in the world and in combat. You may need to spend your downtime training or studying in order to gain the benefits of a new level. So as a player, you will study which things you want in your new level as you look through the player's handbook or any other book that has the race and class info. But then you have to think of it as a further like plan. So it's not, oh, and at the end of the session, you guys all level. Yay. It makes it a little more tricky. So you can determine how to do this by using experience points, if that's how your campaign runs. And then once you have enough to gain a level, you will spend the time training. And the duration of the training depends on the level being attained. Of course, it will probably take longer to level to 17 or 18 versus leveling from 2 to 3. And it will also cost gold. So this is by no means like something you have to do as a DM, but you can set it up that way to add a bit more flavor to the actual leveling of your players. Once you have enough experience points, you can gain a level and you need to spend some time training. The duration of the training depends on the level being attained, and it also costs gold. So there's a lovely table in the DMG that outlines details on this. As an example, it will take 10 training days and 20 gold pieces to go from level 2. And then if you want, same thing if you want to go to level 3 and then level 4. But it will cost you 40 days and 80 gold pieces to gain like level 17. And that again to go to 18 and 19 and 20. So it is a lot of time and a lot of gold for leveling in this way. If we go into the DMG, Xanathar's and Player's Handbook around players learning a new language or a new tool proficiency during downtime, they each have slightly different info there. So the Player's Handbook has where a pretty brief blurb on that. It says that you can find an instructor, make some checks that the DM will decide, and spend 250 days and 250 gold to learn a new language or gain proficiency in a new tool.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah. Like, and especially like, it's just like a blanket statement. So that is Like if you're a level one or you're a new adventurer ring party, 250 gold will be very hard to come by. You will have to do a lot of, you know, adventure deals and bounty deals and stuff like that to get that money. And 250 days is a lot.
Like I get that that is supposed to be like how long it would take to actually not master, but become proficient in a language if you're spending 8 hours a day studying it and whatnot. But I mean, the gold is cost prohibitive, right? You're not doing that till late tier two, if you're lucky, right? Mm-hmm. And that's only one character. Every time that you find there's 100 gold pieces, you're splitting it five ways, right? Like mm-hmm. you're getting 20. So this is a great way to suck up resources, but like, and I don't know, it just feels so ridiculous. Now, granted, you don't come across tool proficiencies or languages easily in fifth edition, so that does make sense. But when you compare that against going from level 19 to level 20 takes less than a sixth of the time and less than a third of the money, that seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even just tracking that, like the DM and then the like player with the character spending 250 days, like it's going to become, it's just going to get lost in the background. Like they're going to just forget about tracking that many days.
If you're unless you do, unless you do the time jump that we did, right? But where we had 300 days of downtime and I said, what do you guys want to do to fill it? This would have been a good thing. I bet Dan would have jumped on this, right?
Yeah.
Or Charlie, right? They would
exactly.
have.
Exactly. Yeah.
No,
go ahead.
I'm just curious how you do 300 days of downtime at a hop without it weighing everything else down, right? When you get into start talking about some of these other ones where it's like you need to roll three checks and then three random DCs for everything. Like,
no, what I did was I broke it down. I split up the session so that I had my party in three different groups, right? My 6-person party was in three groups. And then we sat down and we focused 1 week at a time. And I gave everybody a handout. There were three handouts. The first one was activities. The second one was locations. And the third one was NPCs. And you will spend 1 week. You have 30 weeks, right? Because they're 10 days long. You have 30 weeks where in each week you focus on one of anything on one of those three charts. You can go to a location and explore it for a week. You can go spend some time with an NPC for a week. Or you can do this one thing like train. There was training involved, right? Not for levels, but for like Megan's monk was learning new martial arts styles and things like that. So then we would roll percentile dice. So everybody is essentially rolling percentile dice. And I had a secret table on my side about what the numbers meant for different events or different locations or whatnot. And then I would narrate what happens. And then they would, all right, everybody goes for week one. Now everybody goes for week two. Everybody goes for week three. And we gradually, we tell this story that drastically changes the outcome of what happens over the span of 300 days. It made it so that Dan the Bard could become very proficient in like his performance, and he became locally famous. Casey and Mieka discovered right before this that they were actually long lost sisters. And so this gave them the opportunity to not only get to know each other's characters, but also spend time with the parents as well, because the whole family came together right beforehand. So there was a lot of that. Charlie did a bunch of magical study. Everybody went for the opportunity to go wander around places and learn the local geography a little bit better with ranging groups. So that's how we planned that out. This could have been one of those things. Get a tool proficiency or something, right? Mm-hmm. But you'll see, I had to do that outside of the regular 5th edition rule set. I had to create my own like mini game that would take up 1 week. So,
okay.
Yeah, and Xanathar's adds even more to this. It allows players to learn a new language or new tool proficiency working in work weeks, like Adam mentioned earlier. So it takes 10 work weeks to complete this, which by your standard is 100 days. but it allows you to reduce that time based on your intelligence modifier. Okay. So I guess it makes it so that, like, typically somebody maybe wanting to learn a new language or a new tool proficiency might have a higher intelligence in order to do so. So that gains you a benefit there to take less time. But additionally, it costs 25 gold pieces per week. So that's 250 gold. So that's where we're aligning with the player's handbook.
I like this better.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit more flexible to shorten that time frame. And
well, yeah. You're also going to reward artificers, wizards, and some rogues that have high intelligence, right? Like that makes sense to me for languages and tool proficiencies specifically. So
yeah. And it does make sense. Not surprisingly, there can also be complications during this process. And so this is outlined as well in Xanathar's. This will occur more when you are using like a teacher, or which can introduce rivals for learning a new language or a new tool proficiency. So the math. So there is a 10% chance of a complication in every 10 work weeks. So the training complications can be chosen from a 1d6 table that's in the book, but you also have the freedom to like create this yourself as a DM. One example from the book is that your teacher is a spy sent to learn your plans. So again, derails your learning and maybe add something else that you have to deal with because there's now this rivalry going on. That makes sense to me.
It's interesting. I'm looking at this whole D6 table and it's all based around your instructor making things difficult. There's nothing about other trainees or your tools break or there's conflicting scripts or something like that. Like there could be a lot more here, but it's all very much based on you including an NPC in this conversation.
Yeah. And I guess maybe they wanted to make it that way because like a little later, I'll touch on just using downtime to do research and that lays out a bit more variety there. So okay. I don't know if they maybe wanted to focus on you having to find a teacher for sure for achieving either of these things in downtime and focusing on just the knowledge based that could go get complicated. I don't know.
It's interesting that learning a language is considered a trainable skill instead of it being included in the research rules.
Yeah.
Just interesting. Mm-hmm. Anyways, let's roll dice. I have questions.
7.
10.
A natural fucking 1. Kyle, any sort of class, race, background, archetype, anything that like would lean into training, you think?
I mean, obviously like wizards, alchemists, stuff like that, or artificers. I mean, fighters would make sense. Monks, pretty much everybody, I guess, could be into training. I don't really see it being prohibitive to anybody.
No, I mean, like I said, the learning skills and languages is clearly for high intelligence characters, which makes sense. I like that. That's fine. The gaining a level stuff feels odd. Like what the fuck is a sorcerer doing? Right. So, but I get it. Like this would be considered like rehearsal time for a bard. Right. Yeah. So I'd have to flavor it differently. One of the things that I want to point out is actually I'll save it for my turn. Casey.
So, I mean, I think it could actually work for anybody. Cause I mean, at one point I actually had this discussion with Dave, right. And I was playing a sorcerer and through this like ruin thing, I got a goblin helper who just like followed me around, but the goblin only spoke goblin and I did not speak goblin. So I was like, hey, can I learn goblin so I can communicate with my buddy, right? And he's like, well, sorry, you don't have 250 days to learn this stuff.
Yeah, it would have been a whole lot better if you'd, you know, said, okay, then I'm about to hit level 4. I'm going to raise my intelligence level by 2 so I can shave off a couple of weeks and, you know.
Yeah, I was like, oh, maybe I can like shorten it and we can learn just like hand signs or something like that, which
I don't need to be fluid. I need to be able to grunt at them in the appropriate manner, right?
Yeah. Like, go there, attack that guy.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, and my brain went to if you decide much later that suddenly you do want to multi-class, versus just, you know, roll on up to level 20 with a single class, then you might be lacking something really specific in a proficiency tool that you need. Like, if you want to go into Artificer, you know, there's only two tools as options that you must have in hand in order to do the plethora that the Artificer can do. If you happen to build something that doesn't have either of those things and you don't have them and you're committed to that multi-class, then you're going to have to do something like this.
Yeah. All right.
So at least that's there's a mechanic to do it.
I actually wanted to kind of expound on that a little bit, because that's where I was going to say is, when I think of training, I think of fighter and I think of monk. Right. And neither of those are like, yes, they could gain levels, but for the rest of it, doesn't really scream fighter or monk to me, as much as like they could be reading war histories or, you know, focusing on their dogma or whatnot. What I would like to do, though, and I'm inspired by the picture in Xanathar's, actually, it's of a dragonborn training, but they're training by shooting a bow and arrow at a target. I would absolutely allow you to spend whatever the required time is to learn a new weapon proficiency, but I wouldn't have it be like light weapons or medium armor or anything like that. I would have it be very specifically this one kind of weapon. You spend time with a flail. You are now proficient with all of your regular stuff and a flail. You've spent the time and money on it.
Yeah.
I think that for fighters and monks and whatnot, that could make a barbarians as well. This could make a big difference for some of the more exotic weapons out there and get them to get creative with improvising weapons or making their own weapons and then learning how to use it. I'd also let you learn how to do rituals as spellcasting rituals. There's some casters, or I think every caster now has the ritual tag on it, except Ranger. Absolutely, the Ranger would be able to use rituals if they spend the time learning how to do that. I could fill in blanks here.
Would this be an alternative to feats? Because I mean, both of those things are feats that you can also get, like weapon expert, you get proficiency in four weapons. And then you can get ritual caster as well.
No. If you're going to burn a feat on that, then you go right ahead for immediate gratification, because overnight you immediately get this. So it should have a high cost, right? If you've got the time to put into this, if you know your campaign is going to last 2 years in world, you only have so many different things you can get better at. And if you know that you've got to go to the Underdark, you had better spend however many weeks ahead of time learning Undercommon.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's just because feats are a variant rule, right? So if you don't want to do feats, this is also your way of allowing your players to get the benefits of a feat without actually incorporating them necessarily into your game.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And would you, because instead of, you know, in the instant gratification, having a player go down this route instead, would you give them even an extra edge in whatever they have done if they have learned a language, or like, say, if they have trained with a glaive? Would you limit it just to, yes, you gain proficiency with that, so you get to add like your proficiency, but would you add more to that?
Not for weapons or armor, but I definitely would for things like languages, because there are like multiple scripts that are multiple languages that use the same script, like Giant and Dwarven use the same letters, right? Mm-hmm. And right. So I would be looking up and figuring out, like, if you spend all this time learning how to speak Ignan, then you also have a basic idea on how to speak Aquan, right? Because they're both primordial languages. And so there would be some synergy and some benefits to that. If you can use a longbow, you're now proficient in it. Yay, you can use a longbow. I'm not going to give you short bow as well. Otherwise, you just gained it in all bows, right? Like that's just too much. But I could be argued with at a table, and I might be swayed depending on certain specific cases. We've talked a lot about little like plot hooks and what characters would be interested in, this kind of thing. Do you have anything else that you guys want to add to this, Kyle? Like, is there any quest or anything that sticks out?
Okay, so personally, I'm not a big fan of the whole training to gain levels thing. It just feels like an unnecessary addition, except for what Casey said, where like mentioning multi-classing. I think that is a great idea to do it, especially if you have a player who doesn't really have a good reason to or anything. But I do also see it working very well for, you know, Dragonlance, where they have like the Knight Squire background, right? I think that is it fits in well with that kind of vibe, you know?
Ravnica has a rank system with reputation as well, and it would work well with that as well.
Yeah,
I like it if you have really role play and character development happening at the table, because then the ones that are so invested in every single detail that their player is and how they're going to develop, they have already made the 20 level decisions on what their character is going to do. If you add this in, it just gives them, like, I guess that more realistic feeling of living in their character, because like, oh, well, it makes sense that I've done all of these things and then I am working on this in order to gain the level 5 skills and abilities that you get. And so some players may enjoy that more realistic look, but it takes up a lot of time. And if you don't have a full table that wants to do that, it doesn't make sense for 2 of the 5 to just, you leveled, moving on. And the other ones are now investing in, let's flesh that out. How did I gain those abilities at level 5? And like, you know, doing that whole thing. I guess you could build it into midweek content where some will do it, some won't, and it could be an extra thing.
I did my own version of this midweek with Dan when it was doing research and stuff too, like, but he was trying specifically to learn things, and I considered it to be training. So honestly, my favorite thing about what we did, the training, was my favorite plot hook was Megan joined an underground fighting ring, and she was training fighting during the day, and every weekend she was trying to work her way up the ladder to get into the final bracket, because the top 3 contestants at the end in this underground fighting ring would then be trained by a martial arts master and learn a brand new style. And she ended up learning the flail snail.
Drunken master.
Nope, flail snail style, which gave her the ability to deflect incoming magic spells that target her directly, the same way that she can deflect arrows.
That's pretty cool.
So that was just a direct, like, little extra thing for her monk to be able to do this. But she wasted, I don't want to say wasted, she used up the majority of her time just building towards this one thing, whereas everybody else was building relationships and doing these exploring this area and talking to this NPC. She was like, nope, I'm fighting. And because she devoted all of those resources to it, I have no problem giving her a mechanical bonus for it.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting for if you have a power gamer at your table, right? Like, oh, I'm going to take the X all the way through here, and then I want to have like one level of a Hexblade Warlock dip kind of thing, right? And that's like, okay, but I mean, how are you going to get it? You're going to contact the Raven Queen? Well, you can't do it in the Underdark right now. I mean, your other players got a level, but you're going to have to wait until you're somewhere where you can perform this ritual.
You know, so what else?
Do you really want it? Because, you know, you can have it, but...
I love that. You just inspired me to think, like, instead of a full level, I would absolutely hand out fighting styles to people if they want to train with, like, in a combat arena kind of thing. Yeah. Now, I wouldn't let you have multiple fighting styles active at once. You'd have to wake up in the morning and choose which one you want to focus on that day. Or maybe you declare at the beginning of the initiative, I will be using my defense or my two-weapon fighting or my whatever, right? And so you would swap in between them, but giving fighters and barbarians and paladins, and I'd let rogues take a fighting style. Why not? All the martial ones should be able to. A Hexblade Warlock should be able to, if it makes sense. So
yeah, and it's that make it make sense. So if you're throwing something like to your DM that's just weird because you read about it and it's like, I really want to do this. It's like, Kate, how? Tell me how you would do this given the current scenario your group is in and where you're located. If it makes zero sense, I'm going to push back on it and be like, okay, this is going to be harder than you probably want it to be than just like updating your character sheet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I like your answer. Show your work.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, let's move on to the next thing, because I could talk about training apparently all day. So
yeah. All right, sacred rites. So performing sacred rites is in the DMG, and all it states really is between adventurers, a player can spend their downtime performing sacred rites at a temple they are connected to, doing various services like marriages, funerals, sermons, etc. Performing these services for 10 days can earn a daily inspiration for the next 2d6 days. Now they expand this into religious service in Xanathar's, expanding the rules and just adding more interesting benefits other than inspiration, and also adding a chance of failure and repercussions.
Although, so, I gotta ask, what's the inspiration? Is it just like a d6 die?
Yeah, so what's the original D inspiration?
Is
I think
it
it's like a re-roll a d20. You get an extra roll a d20. I can't remember the original rules for...
I'm just thinking about the bard. That's where I look for it, right?
Which is, yeah, depending on the level.
Yeah, so I would give like a basic one. What's the bardic inspiration starts off at... Oh, it's been so long since I've had to look up a character.
If you have inspiration, you can expend it when you make an attack roll, saving throw, or ability check. Spending your inspiration gives you advantage on that roll.
All right,
that's
perfect.
The original home rule.
Or cool.
That's cool.
So not the bard thing, but yeah, okay, cool.
To be able to perform religious services, you have to have obviously access to a temple with which you are connected to and aligned morally. Now this is also with a week's time, but requires no gold sort of investment. So at the end of the service, players can either roll a persuasion or a religion check. In the book, it allows the player to choose, but I might ask what kind of service they're actually performing and choose the role based on that. I think it also depends on like what kind of god you're serving.
I mean, hell, I might make you roll a performance check depending on what you're doing. If you're like leading a choir or something, right?
Yeah, true. Yeah, so basically if they roll a 1 to 10, nothing happens as they fail to impress anybody at the church. An 11 to 20 gets them one favor from the temple, and rolling a 21 plus gets them two favors. Now these favors essentially work as chits. They can be turned in for services from the temple, whether they be support, be it political, material, magical, or strength of arms. Which one of those might be available to the player is probably going to depend on the temple. But maybe they ask for help getting access to a king, getting a friend released from jail, help healing a particularly nasty curse, or just having kind words spoken about them to the congregation in hopes of, you know, improving the reputation of the party in the townspeople's eyes. Now, how big of an ask the party makes or the player makes is going to determine how many favors it takes. So favors don't have to be used right away, and they can be stored to a maximum of one plus their charisma modifier with a minimum of one favor. Now, seeing as how churches obviously aren't always the beacon of light they hope to portray themselves as, there is the risk of some complications developing. Xanathar's gives us a d6 tables of what those might look like, such as accidentally blaspheming or perhaps angering a fellow priest, maybe through taking the spotlight away from them.
I love the idea that you bust ass to do these like religious services for 10 days and you stub your toe and go, God damn it. And then you fuck it all up.
Yeah.
All right. I want to ask, because I know that you're going to be covering piety here in a second. Do you want to lump them all together or should we ask questions now?
Let's just lump them all together. I mean, sure. I they're like really close together anyway.
Yeah.
So piety in the DMG basically works as an alternate option to the renown system. So the only difference is this time, you know, rather than being looked upon favorably by an organization, you are looked upon favorably by a god. So these are obviously great in campaigns where gods are taking an active role in mortal affairs. So if you are a player, want to integrate this into your game, start by choosing either a god or a pantheon of gods and establish what their goals, doctrines, and taboos are. The bonds, ideals, and flaws of a religion, essentially. Now, with this system, characters can gain piety through acting in accordance to a given god's or pantheon's doctrine and advancing their aims, and risk losing it by working in ways that would be viewed as contrary to its ethos or aims. Those who work towards them can pray for divine blessings once per day and are rewarded for their faithful service, usually in the form of cleric spells like Bless. And these tokens are generally delivered with a sign of the benefactor. So, for example, they pray to Paylor and a ray of sun breaks through the clouds and bathes them in warm light. As they continue along, walking along this god's path, they gain more piety. And along with gaining more piety, they get increased kind of benefits that are becoming stronger and more persistent, maybe coming in the form of a blessing or a charm. So I guess the difference between this one and the religious services is that, you know, you are one of the congregation as opposed to one of the preachers. Now in Theros, they update this going a little bit further, laying out specific persistent gifts God's champion might gain with each rank, and each God's, you know, blessings having their own flavor rather than just kind of a generalized bless. So it also states that players can generally expect to gain one piety per session, but can also, you know, gain extra by performing specific deeds that their gods look upon favorably. Atheros, for example, the god of passage to the underworld, rewards those that treat the dead and the dying with kindness and respect, punishing those who would pilfer tombs or loot dead bodies, while rewarding those who would see the dead and dying treated with respect and dignity. So having their last rites read to them and, you know, putting coins on their eyes to be able to cross the river Styx. So Atheros would bestow gifts, kind of like allowing them to cast gentle repose, speak with dead, false life, all the way to gaining a +2 to wisdom or intelligence, including being able to increase their maximum by 2. Crufix, the god of horizons, smiles upon those that protect the weak from the strong and find compromise instead of resolving problems through swords. So this one will give gifts like being able to cast Detect Magic and Mage Hand, giving advantage on saves against being charmed, up to increasing con or intelligence score and maximums. Not all players, obviously, though, like playing devout characters. So it also gives you other like kind of supernatural gifts you can give to a player if they don't want to go the piety route. Like there's a iconoclast who kind of just rejects that anybody should worship a god or that gods are worthy of worship. They also give you the oracle, so being able to tell the future and stuff like that. Yeah,
I like that. This is, it's interesting because the ones in Xanathar seem to be like what I can get out of the church, and piety is what can I get out of the god, right? Mm-hmm. So let's roll initiative, because guess who has questions? 8.
Uno.
I also rolled 8.
All right, Casey, roll off. 14.
I also rolled 14.
Damn it. All right.
Go 19.
Down. 19? I got 5.
All right, okay.
Oh, I swore you were going to say 19 as well.
So, first and foremost, I guess I'm talking to myself, is there a class, race, background, or character archetype that stands out to you as being thematically tied to the pastime? If I can be honest, clearly clerics, but also paladins. I would absolutely apply this to warlocks who can find members of their cult. I would apply this to druids who worship in certain ways, maybe with certain circles, or to like nature gods themselves, rangers the same way. These are the ones that pray to higher powers for blessings, right? So that makes a lot of sense, but I'm really intrigued mostly by it being the like celestial sorcerer, right? All the ones that don't necessarily make sense, all the subclasses that are tied to angels and gods and whatnot as praying to them. The celestial warlock, it was divine soul sorcerer, I guess is what it is, right? All of these other kinds of subclasses out there that let make you think about religion. The ancestral spirit barbarian might be a good one, right? Or I think the zealot actually has the gods that'll bring them back from the dead for short periods of time and shit. Like there are some that are out there that I think would really benefit from these kind of downtimes of being involved in religious services. Having your barbarian say, you know what? I'm going to church for a week. Might feel a little bit strange, but it would be really cool to have that pay off.
Yeah.
You covered all of it. Well, I would say this is also a great way to beef up a beloved NPC. I'll add that. Like so you can start gaining a level in like if they're tied to your cleric and that's where the partnership is going to end up, you can then start building their skills with piety and their education around the god that the cleric or whatever, the domain that the cleric is under. So it's a way to kind of direct and allow a player to build up an NPC in that way, like a cultist, like you mentioned.
The other thing too, sorry, you could do is have your cleric give the sermon and get the religious services stuff, but everybody else gets piety points if they
attend. that's what I was thinking. It's like, okay, we're going to both gain here.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, I'm going to take you under my wing, but I'm also going to gain like those inspiration points.
First of all, you stole my answer with the warlock one, because I think that it's a great mechanic for it. I also think, you know, clerics can get piety from performing religious service as well, right? If they put on a particularly moving sermon, right, then the god smiles down upon it, right? You know, like, you are showing my best side. Mm-hmm. I also see piety being kind of like a holy warrior stat, right? Like, if you want to play a character that's kind of got the Joan of Arc vibe, right? Yeah. And so, right, they are gonna go do this, they are living the ideals, maybe even the accidental, you know, kind of stumbled along this path, or, you know, has never even heard of a particular god, but are so well living their ideals that, you know, this god is taking an active interest in where they go, right?
Yeah.
Hoping for the best.
And you could even have them like an unexpected interaction, like maybe in their dreams, or they are awoken and they interact with this god, and the god's like, I'm really impressed by you. Do you know who I am? And that could be an intro to bringing in a new god into the group too.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
I gotta say, the big thing that I'm getting from this is that we can stack the piety with the religious services bonuses and like really power up a cleric or a religious character who is not feeling like they're pulling their weight in the party, or they're not getting the boons that others are getting, right? Fighter mm-hmm. gets magic sword. What does warlock get? Oh, warlock gets some piety points, a religious service for his cult, right? It could be cool for even druids. I think this would be so cool for druids too.
I think, but I mean, what is giving them piety? Is it nature itself?
They could, they, like any character, Mother Gaia? Any character can worship any god. There are so many nature gods out there that any one of them. Or you could just have it be Mother Nature itself, right? I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
I did.
Honestly, I think that's what's really cool about the Theros one, is that they've got 16 gods, I think, listed. So it covers the whole spread for ideas.
Well, and I did like how you mentioned there was, if you are god-averse, there's still some options, because maybe a player could start there, or an NPC could start there. The I want to believe, but you know, I haven't seen it, because they don't live in alignment with any of the gods that would, you know, want to reward them. But then, you know, suddenly over time, they start like learning from their like cleric, and you kind of build that up, and then they receive piety for the first time, and they're like, maybe I do believe.
Oh, interesting.
That's something to take into consideration too. Like ASMRs and others, there is proof that the gods exist in this world, right? And having that mm-hmm. reiterated and flashed in front of the player's eyes might be a way to get them on board with this kind of mechanic.
Yeah, that could be a good one. Sure. I was just going to roll us on into research. So I think when a player chooses to do something during downtime, that is not just drinking and fucking, research or finding out knowledge comes to mind probably early on, until they realize there's a lot of these other options. Outlined in Xanathar's is more detail on how to go about doing research in downtime. What this research could be is lore around an enemy or a monster, the location of a hidden magical object, or really anything that makes sense as part of your campaign that none of the players inherently know that you must find out in order to move forward in your adventure. It will take resources to do research. You need to access a source of the information. That might be a library or a sage that is knowledgeable in what you want to learn. Once you find the right resource, the research will take 1 work week and minimally 50 gold pieces on materials and offerings and other expenses involved. After that one work week, the character makes an intelligence check with a plus one bonus for every 50 gold pieces spent beyond the first gold pieces. So if you're loaded, you can make this easier on yourself and you can get up to a maximum of plus six added. You can get advantage on this check as well if you've accessed a library or consulted a sage, as the examples I gave. So there's lots of ways you can go about this, but these would be the best bang for your gold, basically. So there's a table that outlines how this goes based on that intelligence check. So with a total of 1 to 2, there is no resolution and no new knowledge is gained. On a 6 to 10, you learn one piece of lore. An 11 to 20, you learn two pieces of lore. And 21 and over, you learn three pieces of lore.
Casey, I think you said a 1 to 2 is no effect, but I think it's a 1 to 5 because you jumped straight to 6.
Oh, yeah. Apologies. On a 1 to 5, there is no resolution. Each piece of this lore is a true piece of information. It could be giving enemies resistances or something about the monster's statistics, the location of a secret entrance, or even knowledge about like spells that an evil wizard has. Basically, the DM will have the final say on what exactly you can learn, but it is a huge advantage, especially if you have a really challenging piece of your campaign coming, to learn three pieces of lore. So if you have a lot of gold and you want to beef up to have a plus six and advantage on this, an over 21 like stat might be feasible.
I like this.
I have mixed thoughts, mixed opinions.
So again, there can be complications with this. The easiest one here is that you can learn false information or be led astray by your teacher. So there's a theme here. There is a 10% chance of a complication in each work week spent in research. So the chance of complication is actually higher, but it's still calculated as that 10% chance in each work week. And there is a 1d6 table in the book to outline some of the complications you could face. An example is that you accidentally damage a rare book. And another one is a sage becomes obsessed with convincing you of a number of strange theories about reality, leading the research astray. So that goes into quite a bit more detail. One aspect of this that is in the player's handbook is that you can also just learn information and do research by talking to people around the town. And it brings in that one gold per day cost to doing that. And it's up to the DM's discretion on how they want to play that out as well. And yeah, that's research.
That's wild. Let's roll initiative. Yeah, I got another 19.
Okay.
Ew.
8.
All right. Aww. So same order, I guess. First of all, the class, race, background, or archetype that's going to lean into this is clearly wizard, but honestly, I could see anybody doing it. I know that lore bards specifically as well would love this, but this could be anybody. It's based on the player more than the character who wants to do the research, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. I kind of see this as coming into play a lot when you don't have a large party, when you might be in a campaign where you're playing just one-on-one with the DM, and say you're a fighter and you are missing a lot of information around things that you're needing to do, whether it's your choice or you've been put into that role. And so this would be a way to fill the gaps on that. And it would be harder, like if the player is something like a fighter, because they won't necessarily have the right alignment of stats on it. So you can make it extra hard that way if you go outside of classes that don't use intelligence. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you're already getting punished for not, you're doing the intelligence check, right? So you already don't have a high modifier.
Mm-hmm.
So I it's going to depend entirely upon, I don't like the 1 to 20 check. I would rather just add a DC
for, yeah, me. For how rare the information is.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts on this, but let's, Kyle, what are your thoughts for player types?
Okay, so it's less about player types and more about settings. Like, I think this would be more interesting mechanic for a low magic setting, just where players don't have access to stuff like identify and legend lore or mm-hmm. even any sort of like divination spells, right? It's just like, if you have to grind, I guess, a lot more for information, or something like, I don't know, Tomb of Annihilation, where you're going into tombs and, you know, this time you're researching on site, right? So you might be trying to decrypt hieroglyphics or something like that, which I think would be, it's going to require a little bit of tuning for whatever campaign. But I mean, it just seems really expensive mm-hmm. compared to the rest of the things. For maybe not as good of a benefit, right? Like, you learn one piece of lore, and I spent 300 gold pieces to get an added 4 to my bonus because I've got low intelligence. So this is my only option for getting these particular pieces of information. And just like, for one piece of lore, doesn't really seem that great, I guess.
If I can be honest, I think all of this is just the tip of the iceberg. There should be DCs that are set. One of the things that I love to do is, depending on how well you roll, I will add rumors as well. Like, then mm-hmm. that's just standard. You learn definitely this. You've been able to cross-reference it 3 different ways. Trolls are weak against fire. One person said they're weak against acid and someone else said water. So who knows? And one person says that if you wear a circular amulet, then that will ward off their attacks. One of those is blatantly wrong. One of those is kind of helpful. You got a 50-50. And one of those is absolutely the correct answer. And that's going to be depending on how much you beat the DC by. I don't like this mechanic here. I also think if you've got the sage background, you should be getting bonuses. If you are playing Candlekeep and you're in Candlekeep, you shouldn't have to bribe people to get access to this shit, right? Yeah. So I'm with you 100%, Kyle. It should be setting dependent, but I also think it's character dependent as well. And
well, it does say in the thing that a character who has access to a particularly well-stocked library or knowledgeable sage gains advantage on the check. So it does kind of account for that. But I mean, for the rumors, that's what taverns are for. Like, I'm not going to overload my characters on potential rumors, like when I've already got a source for that, I guess.
The only reason that I add shit like that is because Dan is a fucking, he's not actually a lore bard, but he might as well be. When you have a Dan at your table who already knows the monster manual inside and out and understands great lore about the region and whatnot, and you've got to create new little bits and pieces and add on obscure monsters from some of the books that you know, this experienced player hasn't read, it's good to obfuscate that a little bit and get them to try different things. I think that research is fantastic for a horror campaign where you have to figure out, imagine if your players didn't know to use silver against werewolves, right? Yeah. And they would have to learn that by piecing together information from the investigator of the murder, right? Or the weird woman outside of town who knows all the local folklore or whatever, right? So, like, this, I feel like there's more than just reading dusty tomes when it comes to research. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of skimmed over. These intelligent sages should be a sphinx or even a manticore. These things can talk. Go talk to them, get that info. And then I'm not worried about 100 gold pieces. I'm worried about trials and tests and tributes, right?
Yeah, and that's where I guess I was kind of, my brain went to, was using this as potentially the segue into your series 2. Okay, so say you have your giant battle, and in this time you have had to rally troops. So there's the core party, there's a bunch of powerful NPCs that you have now fallen in love with, and they're part of the whole group. You defeat the enemy. However, there is something that plagues one of the NPCs or one of the players that none of you have ever seen before and you don't understand it. And so as you recover from that final big battle, you then have to investigate and figure out what's going on. And yes, that might lead you to then seeking out some sort of like potential enemy that you have to try and get information from in order to like save the player or the NPC from being, I don't know, like cursed or slowly decaying away or something, like something is plaguing it. And so this is how you could introduce that, where players have to do some research. And in that research, they might find out that we all have to go find this Sphinx and try and figure out how to get the information from them, which would then result in many other adventures that you have to do to satisfy them in like an alignment.
The other thing that I want to point out is that this doesn't cover forbidden knowledges at all, which is actually a theme in a lot of D&D, where you're getting info that you shouldn't have. And
That could get you in trouble.
Yeah, I might be challenging my Call of Cthulhu a little bit on this one, but like, you should have a sanity score if you're reading forbidden knowledges. You should have the, it's like we did with the Necronomicon in our last campaign, Casey, where if you had access to the whole thing, you fucking die. You cannot handle all of that knowledge. So it was split into two parts, one that our gnome investigator got and one that our necromancer got, right?
Right.
One was based on lore, the other was based on understanding the mechanics of the creatures themselves, right? So there's a lot of different ways to go about forbidden knowledge, but I do love the idea that there is one scroll and it is a race against time with you and your rival to get to this scroll, or you have to gain the favor of a specific high wizard to get access to it. But once you read it, once the scroll has been read, the ink evaporates off of the page and no one else can read that scroll ever again. It's just paper now. Right? Shit like that. This is the complications for research that I'm looking for. Do we have any other plot hooks or adventure ideas or anything? I mean, that would be mine.
Well, even just building off of that, that's when in that part of the campaign, your wizard or whoever's trying to gain this knowledge is maybe at the forefront. It's like their story and their building of their, like their backstory. You could fill in a lot of that. But then in order to find that information or be protected from some of the stuff that will come up in reading the forbidden knowledge, you need your fighters, your barbarians, you need the rest of your party to help you with that. So it can align well for a pretty decent piece of the campaign, I would say.
Kyle, any thoughts?
I like the idea of the complication being getting to wherever the information is, right? Like, let's say you are trying to track down a rare, lost, a forgotten city, right? And the only place where this information might be is in the very bottom of a castle library, right? So you need to figure out ways to get access to this, because it is normally only for monks of a particular order, and they don't allow access to just anybody to get in there. So your players have to figure out a way in there, and then once they do, you know, they're rolling on this table, and let's say they're trying to find the location of the city. If they roll high, they can narrow it down to one place or one area. But if, you know, they roll low, it's like it's in any one of these three potential places that they might have to go.
I like that. You give them a map that has like seven or eight really similar locations on it, and they've got to narrow it down over weeks of research, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and if there's like major complication, it's that the word is just inscribed wrong, and when you translate it, it's a different location on the map, but both exist.
or like it's you can get the information, but it's in a different language, or it's a word, but you don't know what language it's in. And in Dwarven, it means this. In Giant, it means this. In Draconic, it means this.
Yes. Like,
well, what? Which, fuck. Okay.
Yeah.
More research needed.
You know, like one word is smudged on it, and now you need to track down someone who restores old documents for a living.
Or even go speak with Dead, the person that actually wrote it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Anyway,
yeah.
There's a lot of different options for research. I do think that what's provided is tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
I like it as a base level of inspiration, but we need to go further on it.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So that brings us to the last thing that we're going to talk about today, and that's making those dollar bills, yo. How many people are cringing? Because they should all be. One of the downtime options in the player's handbook is called practicing a profession, which means getting your ass a job. If you can find work between adventures, then you can support a modest lifestyle, which according to the player's handbook means you can hold one gold piece per day. If you're a member of a guild or organization, you can work for them and support a modest lifestyle, which means you can earn two gold pieces per day. Sorry, that's a comfortable lifestyle. If you are an entertainer with a proficiency in performance, you can try your hand at performance checks to live a wealthy lifestyle, which means you earn four gold pieces per day. Now, four gold pieces a day is 40 per week. That's fucking intense. I'm not even going to go adventuring at that point. Can we just hang out? I got to sing the blues for the next month. I want to get rich. When it comes to Xanathar's, it does give us some updates. And the first one is that a lot of people want to actually run a business to make money on the side instead of just working for someone else. I know a lot of dungeon masters over the years that have created massively convoluted rules about income, patronage, marketing, trade routes, economies, and more in order to satisfy these needs. I myself am guilty of over-engineering the details of running a business, but there are some very basic rules in the DMG for this, and it's okay. You make a percentile roll and you add a number of days up to 30 that the character can spend devoted to the business. Then compare the number to the D100 table to determine if you're profitable. And spoiler alert, anything below 40 is going to cost you money, and anything above 60 will pull a modest profit. If you roll low, but you can't pay your debts, you get a minus 10 penalty on the next roll, and this stacks. If you miss payments for 180 days, you could have a minus 60 modifier.
Going to debtor's prison.
Yeah, pretty much. So there are no details about removing these negatives, but I assume that clearing the debt will do that. There are also no indicators for what might increase sales or patronage, and adding things like magical moving signs out front or a deal with local dwarven brewers or hiring specific employees might raise your rolls. But I only do that by like one, two, or three, right? Because you're rolling on percentile tables, and these little increments will stack quickly as your players get creative and they want that money. And I would not increase the amount of money they necessarily make, right? Because it's going to get out of hand fucking quickly. If running a business seems like too much effort, but you still want to make a living, Xanathar's has expanded rules here as well. You get paid after one work week, but you have to make an appropriate check based on the work that you're doing at the DM's discretion. When they check the table on page 134, they'll determine what kind of lifestyle you can afford. If you rolled a 9 or lower, that gets you 20 silver pieces for your week of work. If you roll a 10 to 14, that nets you a total of 10 gold pieces. That actually sounds like it's less because 20 silver pieces to 10 gold pieces. But remember, Electrum exists. And so there's actually a middle step in there. And that's why it sounds lower than 20 silver pieces. It's actually worth more. 10 gold is worth more. If you roll a 15 or 20 on the checks, you get 20 gold pieces. And if you get over 20, you get 45 gold pieces for 7 days of work, one work week. That's a fucking lot. But
what would even be like, what example would you even have to do that? Like, you'd have to be high level.
Yeah. The idea, I guess, is that the DM chooses what the role is going to be, what skill you have to roll. And then, I mean, your bard is going to have a +9, right, in it in the first place. So
yeah.
It's not inconceivable that by the time that you hit high level 2, you're able to pull 45 gold pieces for a week's worth of work. But also, I want to remind you, most tables are not having that much downtime. So yeah. I would really divide that down to be like per day, right? And in that case, it's going to be not as much gold as you think.
Yeah.
One of those things too, like what kind of jobs are you getting with what skill you're using, right? Like with strength, are you a bouncer? Are you pulling a mine cart versus
general labor? You're a mason, like assistant, like it's going to be that kind of shit. But it could also be like you're going to get hired by the weaver, so you need sleight of hand, right?
Yeah, but I mean more like, okay, you think about let's say a bard performing in a bar, right? The better he performs, the more tips he makes, so it makes sense that he could make 45 gold in an evening. But you know, if you are working as a mason or hauling a minecart, you're not going to pull in 45 gold when they could hire 50 of you for a quarter of the price.
I agree with you 100%. There are also complications though, and I feel like the more public, the more, it doesn't say this, but the more reward, there's got to be more risk. I would say that there's a 10% chance that you're going to run into something that's going to piss you off, because no work is complete without complication, as we all fucking know in real life. However, there are going to be, a bard is going to run into a couple of things. If they're going to get 45 gold pieces, there's going to be a couple of complications. There's a D6 table that outlines complication options, like a criminal organization is targeting you, or your employer just can't afford to pay you this week. But I would have complications that would be a little bit more subtle. Like there's a heckler in the audience, and that's going to give you a -2 on your roll, right? I'm going to have you have to overcome this. Everyone here heard this shtick last night. It's not going to pay off as well, you know, as it did opening night. Shit like that. So the moment that you start to add a little bit of common sense to working and running a business, the more you either have to apply these complications to the work side or get very, very generic to the running the business side. Let's grab dice because I want to talk about this.
7-3.
I am on fire.
I got an 11. I feel like we tied earlier and then you beat me and you used up all of your luck, Kyle.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Do you need a hug?
No, I'm good. More like a nap.
So when we look at class, race, background, or character archetype here, honestly, depending on the work, it could be for anybody. They call out entertainers, so clearly bards, but like it could be anybody depending on the work you're doing, right? Although I feel like if you're going to be a cleric and you're doing the work, you're just going to go use those sacred rites and religious services rules and piety like we talked about before. So I don't know, how do you guys feel? Casey, I think you were next.
Yeah, weirdly enough, my brain didn't go to enter the entertainment industry. I was thinking like you may have originally started running your business, like you were the cleric, and so you opened a like healing like cottage, and so you're the healer and you turn it into a business where maybe it's not for coin, but it's for contributions, things like that. I agree. You could use it in any way, shape, or form. Maybe you actually don't have a set business in a set location, but you're traveling business. Like you are a druid and you can relieve livestock of problems and disease, or you can work with people's animals to do something to help them. And so you kind of go to different towns and present your business and see who would like to take you up on your services. It's endless. Like, and I obviously thought about Dan's character who had a detective business. And so like, I don't know, it you could take this anywhere you want to go.
Honestly, yeah. I think that the running a business doesn't apply, but like the work does for just being like a mercenary group as well. And that could be the whole freaking plot hook for your campaign, right? Is we go town to town fixing problems.
Yeah. And even like bounty hunting or sellsword, like all of that is essentially a business.
Interesting. And then rolling is how well you negotiate for your prices.
Yeah. That makes more sense to me than like the outcome being here it is. And we just kind of hand waved it. Like I'm going to hand wave the blacksmith apprentice that you're going to be, right? But again, if you do this enough, do you tie this into the training so you can become a good enough blacksmith and open your own business later, right?
Yeah, interesting. I do.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, I like the idea of tying it into other things, right? Like, I like it being a nice little side benefit, I guess, right? Like, let's say your rogue is wanted by the law, right? So he's trying to throw off the authorities by pretending to be just like a regular stable hand, right? Oh, that guy, no way he could be a thief. He's been, look how good he does with horses, stuff like that. Or, you know, like Casey said, working with animals in a city, you know, you do your job really well. You roll on this table. People love you. More people come to you for business. You know, you're spoken well of in the town. I like the idea of tangible benefits outside of just monetary.
I was going to say, I agree with you 100% on both things. One, this seems like it has great synergy with almost everything else we've talked about today. But two, you're going to be known around town. This is how you build your reputation as well, right? And I think even if you're a blacksmith's apprentice, for example, some people will recognize you as the blacksmith's apprentice when you are in town square, right? Dealing with a massive mob situation of some sort. They'll be like, hey, I know that guy. I trust him, or I laughed with him, or I bought him a beer because he made this for me when I needed it. Shit like that, right?
Yeah. And like family reputation, the family business. It could be mafia style or it could be a bakery. But it just builds that interest.
Or it's a bakery run by the mafia. And yeah, that's what we're all here for. That is D&D. Do we have any quick plot hooks or anything else? We've just like listed off a bunch. Is there anything else you want to cover before we wrap up this episode?
No, I think that covers it for me.
Yeah, again, you could flesh this out so much further than just that basic stuff. There's so much discussion you could have, and it could apply to anything.
Again, yeah, the tools that I want to use here are more about rewards, interesting rivals and complications, and adding minor modifiers to the system that already exists. I don't need to rewrite everything. I don't have to kind of redesign the wheel on this. These checks are fine. If I wanted to get a little bit more in depth, I'd add a DC and make that kind of check instead. But mm-hmm, I don't have to create trade routes and economies and shit like that. Just assume it works in the background. Believe me when I say 99.9% of tables don't give a shit about the math that you, the Dungeon Master, have plugged into a spreadsheet. I am speaking from personal experience on this. I distinctly remember how Casey's eyes glazed over when I handed out handouts. This was years ago, saying, so here's the economic breakdown. You guys are running the city now. What NPCs do you want to put in charge of what, and how much money do you want to make? And she was just like, I don't give a fuck. I work Monday to Friday. I don't need to work Sunday too.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. Someone else decide.
So before we finish this episode off, let's jump to a last info break.
If you've been inspired by the conversation in this episode, please feel free to reach out and share your creativity and ideas with us and the rest of the community. You can reach us on Facebook and Instagram, or on our subreddit, r/itsamimic, where we keep a place for you to ask mailbag questions as well as our episode guide. Also, if you're feeling particularly generous, please follow and subscribe and leave us positive reviews, likes, and comments. Engagements like that help us pop up on search engines and keep this show running.
Okay, so I talked a little about training for player characters, but would you also allow sidekicks, NPCs, or mounts to train as well?
Kyle, you've been going last all episode. Do you want to go first this time?
Yeah, sure. Hell yeah, I would. Honestly, that sounds like one of the best uses I could think of, right? Like, I'm going to send the sidekick away. We're not going to have them for a while, but when they come back, they are going to have this skill that our party is desperately missing. Or, I mean, NPCs maybe, but unlikely, but sidekicks and mounts definitely.
Casey?
Yeah, I completely agree. Yes. Why not? Why not do it? I didn't ever actually think about mounts being trained, but hell yeah, that would be fun, because maybe it's not your typical mount, which tends to happen in campaigns too. You come across this giant creature, you get a soft spot in your heart for it, and it's like, maybe it could just be my mount. And then, you know, you dedicate some time to get it trained so that you can ride it, or it can pull your wagon for your party. It's easy. And in the campaigns that I've played in, I didn't necessarily deep dive into the training, but a number of the other players did, and did train sidekicks and NPCs to have, you know, trained guards and whatnot. So it's great.
That's absolutely my answer too. I want to remind everybody that sidekicks, NPCs, and mounts, they have rules, but you don't have to adhere to them. You're the DM. So you can use that training to give them proficiencies that they wouldn't normally have, to teach mounts more complicated tricks, or
teach them to wear heavy armor.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Like there are commands. There are very basic commands that some mounts will follow. But there's no reason why you can't add those to other mounts, or add more complicated demands or commands to them, right? You could also, that training for NPCs and sidekicks and mounts should also be ingratiating you towards them when it comes to things like persuasion checks or animal handling checks, as the case may be, so that if you've spent 250 days or whatever training them, they know you, they listen to you. You have not just trained them in a specific thing, but you have built trust, and that should pay off as well.
Interesting. Also, they have to pay you for the privilege of being taught.
That's true. You get to be, okay, so hold on. Do you make the money based off of the training wages that we talked about, or off of the work or running a business wages?
Oh, yeah, it's interesting, because you have to factor in, like, how much money does a sidekick have? And then does this training translate? Are they going to owe you favors now?
You remember me saying how we can over-engineer this shit really easily?
Yeah.
I would have it really be that simple, that, hey, if you're going to do this, then you will be apprentice or squire level. You will carry my gear. You will be essentially my personal assistant on shit when we are not training. So that's usually how I've run sidekicks and NPCs that are tagging along in the past. And clearly a mount is not going to be able to pay you. You are getting the benefits, not the mount.
Love is a payment.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Love is a payment is a slippery slope for Dungeons & Dragons. We should move the fuck on, Casey.
Anyways, that's all for this part of our discussion on downtime. Please take a second to engage with a like, follow, comment, and review to help push our engagement. And don't forget to subscribe to find future inspirations for your campaigns.
If you'd like to support us, we have a store with some merch and a donate button on our website, www.itsamimic.com, as well as a Patreon. This episode and others can also be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and most other podcast apps. Thanks again for listening to It's a Mimic, where you never know what you're gonna get.
This has been an It's a Mimic production. Please check the show notes for this episode to see links, time codes, and credits. And don't forget to reach out and share your own inspirations.
So there's kind of different guidelines between the DMG, the Xanathars, and the Player's Handbook. The Player's Handbook sets it up most simply. Basically, you find an instructor and you make some checks that the DM will decide. You spend 250 days and 250 gold to learn a new language or gain proficiency in new... Oh no, that's for the next one. Okay, scratch that, Adam.
Done.
Yes. Okay, let me say this next piece and then we'll jump back into that. Okay. So yes. So I'm going to repeat that so you can find where to pick it up. You threw me, Adam, by adding new info.
It's Dan's fault.
Well, that's it. Fly, my little dragons. Have a fantastic day.